It's session number 17620, James Watts, Reel 5.
Mr. Watts, Reel 5. When you joined the battalion, were you taught the light infantry pace from the very beginning, or did you build up to it?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, when we were at Brandsmouth, I saw them on parade, and the lads who'd been in the army about a fortnight longer than myself were marching around at a very fast pace. And we had to do the same. So, yes, we were taught the light infantry pace. On a route march, of course, I remember walking out of barracks and I was at the front. I was a corporal at the time. And I was going hell for leather. Because that's how I like to move. And the old sergeant major at the back sent a messenger up and said, "Will you tell young Watty to slow down? We can march Northumberland Fusiliers pace if you don't mind." He was an old Northumberland Fusilier. Of course, I just dropped pace, you see. But it was a feature that if you were out walking, marching, as you were approaching the barracks, you'd get the order to march to attention. So you'd have to straighten up, and you carry the rifle at the trail, and you'd march in at 140. To do that, on one occasion, we were moving along the road and we're about half a mile from the barracks when out from behind a copse on the right hand side came the DLI band. And we all put our shoulders back and marched in. And we'd done about 25-mile route march that time. And we marched in without any bother.
The various calls to duties and so forth, that was done by bugle, was it?
That's right, yes.
And you learned those?
Yes. There's one particular call, by the way. It goes, da 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 da. You know what that means? If you want to have a piss fallout. If the bugler was present on a route march, you'd blow that, and that was that. And I said to the Sergeant Major, "What is that call for, Sergeant Major?" And he told me.
Did you learn these calls gradually, or were they kind of a forced effort where you had to try and take them in quickly?
Well, you know, bugle calls, you know. I don't know whether you've listened to tapes of General Horrocks, but he said that the bugler parodies, you know, he parodies the call. So if you get a call like 24, 34, he'll go sick no more, the poor bugger is dead, you know. And then if, come and do a picket, boys. Come and do a guard. You may think it's easy, boys, but it's very hard. Now, those calls are remembered by the bugler. And come to the cookhouse door, boy. Come, you know, all these different types of calls. And then you've got the different calls that which would be necessary in battle where you would advance. You know, you blow the advance and the recall, last post. But I particularly heard, when I was already sergeant, later on in my career, I heard the call, which of course is not our reveille, it's the American reveille, and I know the bugler who blew that call.
Was he in trouble?
No, nobody twinged it, but I did, because I was up, you see, and apparently he'd blown it out of the window from his bed.
So the bugle was the way of pushing information around to the unit.
Yes, very effective. I like the bugle.
School Aycliffe at that time would be out in the fields. It isn't as it is now.
No, yes, that's right. It was a
so you weren't disturbing the local populace.
No. But it's no, I like bugle calls. They're very distinctive. I like them better than the trumpet.
And they covered a multiplicity of things, did they? large, you know, calling you out for not only for meals but for and parades, but distinctive ones for sergeants going to meeting or whatever.
Oh yes, you could get the orderly sergeant, or you get the orderly sergeant of the day in the respective companies.
Officers' calls.
Yes, the.
It must have been a large number to remember to take on.
Oh, I think the buglers, because they weren't musicians, you know. They're not as such, because there's only about, I think, a good bugler can blow 8 notes on a bugle, but the majority of the calls are in 5 notes. But cookouts, of course, was a favourite call. Yeah, I think there was one, letters from Lazy Lou. Letters from Lazy Louie, letters from Lazy Lou. That's the post. You know, the post arrived. And I'm trying to think, there's quite a number which I could, you know, you haven't had time to reflect to you.
Yeah, initially, when you first joined, as I say, you'd only been in the army 3 weeks, and basic drill would still be the order of the day, was it?
Yes. Yes.
As that, as you took that on board and improved, was your training then expanded into other areas?
Yes.
I'm thinking of field,
especially
field craft
and so on. Especially for some individuals, it was more than others. You see, we went away on courses.
Now, you became a Lance Corporal, was it, first?
Yes, after 10 weeks with the battalion, I was made a Lance Corporal. I was still training.
And being made a Lance Corporal, had you, obviously, you must have been in the eye of the officers to do this. Were you being sent on courses to prepare you for promotion?
Not at that time. I was made a Lance Corporal, and usually, on reflection, I would be put with someone who wasn't picking it up as quickly as he should, and I would take him to one side and show him how I did it.
And could you tell me the Lance Corporal's duties? Because in the army, I've heard that the Lance Corporal is almost the lowest of the low.
Well,
everybody above him in the,
he's acting, acting unpaid, unwanted, and undernourished. No, he has a duty. It's not much of a rank, really, for commanding, you know. It's more or less leading. You lead somebody by example. I think the Lance Corporal is the star among the privates, and they all should look up to him and want to be like him, and he wants to be like the corporal, and so on. It's when you start looking to somebody above the rank that you want to worry, because you're getting above your station.
Did you get paid as a Lance Corporal?
Yes, I got paid all the time I was promoted.
How much extra did you get for that?
Can't remember. I think I got about 6 months a day more. That
and
went home.
And your rank, in effect, your duties were very much, obviously, the disciplinary ones, but was more a showing. You were taken out to show.
That's right, yes. If for instance, you're going to fall a platoon in as a platoon commander, you would probably select a Lance Corporal or somebody who you thought would be good enough to be a Lance Corporal to be the right marker. You see, it's what it is, you're instilling in them a bit of pride in themselves. You know, why has he picked me for to do this? It's because we think he's got a bit that might be coming useful.
Lance Corporals, did you mess still with the men, or was there corporals mess?
Yes, no, corporals and Lance Corporals would mess all together in the same dining room. But in the NAFI, there would be a corporals mess and a privates mess. That was the only difference in our battalion, that was. I don't know whether it was particular to other battalions, but that was our battalion.
And mess, your corporals mess didn't bring you privileges that the privates mess had?
Not really.
It was just that
we were segregated. You see, I think there's a certain amount of segregation where you've got command of someone. I think you can't be too pally, but you can't be inhuman. You've got to learn about people, and you've got to learn what makes them tick, not what makes you want to make him tick. You've got to find out what makes them tick and use that to your advantage.
The extension of your training beyond the drill system. Did you learn or taught gas precautions?
Yes.
What well, did
I
that
was,
entail?
I was once told I was the only one in the battalion who could give a lecture on gas and not have the men go to sleep. If they did, I used to throw a little file about. Tear gas. And then check if the doors off that was. Because there was one lad, Stockton lad, who he used to doze off and he told his sergeant that he'd been in the Merchant Navy and when he was in East Africa he'd got sleepy sickness.
The gas lectures you were giving, what gases were you covering?
Chlorine in the main, mustard. Chlorine and mustard gas.
So there was still a fear in the army that these could be used.
Oh yes. We had our gas capes. The gas cape was like a little oil proof that went over the top of all your equipment, and if in my case it stretched round well below my knees, so that it was a good thing for shedding in what we thought might be coming. But and of course we were more or less told to keep our respirators all the time. If we went on leave, we had to carry our respirator, where we take our dirty socks and our underwear home and get our mothers and wives, etc., to clean it. But strangely enough, when I got abroad and went into action, we forgot about the gas mask with the satchel,
which is carried on your chest.
But we did carry our gas capes. And that was one of the best bits of equipment I had, because I could more or less crawl into a hedge, put my gas cape on, and double up my knees, and I was sheltered from the wet. It was a good thing. Not perfect for it was, but it was, I mean, they were probably being misappropriate for their intention, but I think that was a good piece of equipment.
You say you gave lectures on chlorine and mustard gas.
Yes. That came later, more or less, when I was a full corporal.
But what kind of things were you being told to defend yourselves against, that these things? Can you protect yourself?
Well, we never had the opportunity to test it, but the thing was that we were relying on our respirator, which wasn't like the civilian issue, you know.
What was your respirator like?
Well, at once it fitted over and had like an elephantine tube. You know, it went into the canister on your tube. That was inside the satchel. And that probably would have charcoal in or something like that. I think I can't remember what it really contained. But we had a lot of confidence in it. We were taught to advance through smoke with the respirator on and to... We were taught manoeuvres with respirator on, you know, advancing in line and into battle and even digging with respirators on if necessary. Because that's what you had to do, you see, in such a situation. But that never arose, thank heaven.
Had you to bring the mask out and get it on within a certain period of time?
As quickly as possible, yes.
Was there a drill to it, or just grab it and get it on?
More or less, well, there would be, put your gas mask on quick, you know, and that was it. No, there wasn't any specific drill for that, except for you to move fast. They might say, you know, I have to do it a bit quicker than that, because, you know, that little bit that you breathe in too much, that fettles you.
Could you see through them when you had them on?
No, they used to steam up. Because, you see, I mean, the infantryman's got to move. And if you move, you sweat. But they were an encumbrance.
Did you have to go through the gas chamber?
Oh, yes. Yes.
How was that done?
Well, you just go in one door and they just drop a file and out the other door. They keep you inside for a while and make you come out with the eye stream. Just
take your gas mask off.
That's right. It would just be a slight, you know, but that would give you an idea. And then they would tell you that, just remember that it's going to be 1,000 times worse than this. So that's how quick you've got to move. Actually, we used to use the gas chamber as a refuge for the picket in inclement weather. You have to go in there with icy cold.
Bayonet drill, how was that done?
Well, we used to have a long pole with a pad on one end and a rope on the other end. We used to clip them with the paddle end if they weren't quick enough, but they had to aim for the rope with the bayonet through the middle. And you didn't have to stick it in right up to the hilt. 3 to 4 inches is more than enough. That's what we were taught.
Was it an important drill in the British Army?
It's necessary to be able to use your weapon, your rifle, not only to fire, but also as for close quarter work. Because you've got your bayonet and you've got your butt of your, and that's quite a weapon. Fortunately for me, I didn't, for most of the time I was in battle, I carried a Thompson machine gun.
Training would take in field work, fire and movement, this kind of thing. What was being taught at that time to infantry in the army?
Well, at School Aycliffe, we were really taught the basics. We weren't trained like as followed at the School of Infantry. Remember that there weren't. I don't know how many schools of infantry there were, but this was a specialised type of work, because we were perfecting drills which would be carried out in the field, even at up to a brigade level, and we were witnessed by high-ranking officers.
Well, we'll come to that as a special item.
Yes.
Can we still stick to School Aycliffe? You mentioned that some of the companies were out on airfield defence. Did you get involved on that?
No, never had to go out. The only time I went out was when I went out with the butcher to Middleton St George, and he was delivering some meat to B Company. He was a friend of mine. He said, would I like a ride out? It was a Saturday afternoon. So we went out and I enjoyed the trip out.
Any excitement that you know of on these airfields when this work was going on?
Well, not for me personally, but there was one occasion when an aeroplane, I think it was flown by Canadians, because the Canadian Air Force were at Middleton St George, or Goose Pool, or Middleton One Row. It's Teesside Airport now. And one of the planes was coming in and it crashed. And one of our lads, a lad called Parry, he was only dressed in PT kit. He flung himself on the barbed wire to enable the rescuers to get over to get to the... I believe he was recommended for a medal, but he never got one. He was worthy of a mention, because I think that was pretty... That was brave. Fling yourself on barbed wire with just a pair of shorts on and a singlet. You know, there's not many men would have done that.
Was the Royal Ordnance Factory your neighbours at this point?
Yes, it wasn't far away. It was. I think it was becoming more and more established. But they manufacture the ammunition there, and we would take our weapons down to test the quality of the ammunition, I didn't do it actually myself, but I know that our battalion, the lads probably from the company in brigade, in division, battalion headquarters, it would be the company that would go down and test the weapons, because they were more skilled than what we were, more trained.
There would be lots of young ladies working on the factory. Did any liaisons take place, or was there any opportunity for
them? I think you must have, you've got to admit that there would be some fraternisation going on between. It was the same with the ATS. One or two of them got married. Girls in the Nuffy, they would get married, you know, I think there's some happy moments come out of that.
I was told by another chap who was in the 70th Battalion that you'd got involved with farm work and working the farmer's land at one point.
No, I didn't. What I did was I used to travel back from Sunderland to Aycliffe at the time, and there was quite a number of Land Army girls who worked in around Sedgefield area, you know, because, I mean, geez, after all, Durham County is a good agricultural area. But
This chap said that, well, we had to go and help to pick potatoes or something.
No, I never had to do that. I'll tell you what we did have to do in the winter of 1941-42. It was very, very hard winter and quite a lot of snow fell, and we went down onto the A1, which ran through Aycliffe Village to Ferry Hill and on to Chesley Street, etc., to the north, and we piled the snow in tiers, so that eventually we were working in platforms, and I think the snow at one place was about 9 to 10 feet high, and we lifted up in big blocks, which was similar idea to when you dig trenches. You know, you make platforms and then you do another and pile the stuff up.
Did you get leave from school, Aycliffe?
Oh, yes. Easy to get home. We travelled on the ABC buses, the Triumph buses, which plied between Darnton and Sunderland and Newcastle, of course. We could get home on the train quite easily. But that, in the main, I travelled on the bus. Oh, I got a lift on a brewery wagon. Vaux wagons, and Colonel Vaux, of course, is an old DLI man. I'm not so sure he wasn't the original founder of the Boy Scouts. I know it's a credit to Baden Powell, but I reckon Colonel Vaux was quite a man in the Boy Scouts movement. So that if we had the DLI badge on, we could easily get a lift off a Vaux wagon.
And at home, your mother must have been pleased that you were still close and could get to her.
Yes, I think she was. I think she was. There was one occasion when I went down. I was absent without leave. Nobody knew, because I got home on the Saturday afternoon, and she said, "You usually come on a Friday night. Why are you coming this afternoon?" She says, "Have you just walked out of the barracks?" I said, "Yes." She says, "Well, get yourself back." And I returned immediately. So nobody knew I was missing.
After the first colonel left, how long was he there?
Colonel McBain. About 3 months.
And you got Peter Jeffries next?
I got Peter Jeffries.
Was there changes in the battalion routine because of change of officers?
No, it changed very, very little. I think at that time, you see, Colonel McBain, I think, left in the spring of 1942, by which time the disbandment of the Young Soldiers Battalion and our consequent move to the School of Infantry was probably in situ, and that might have been why Colonel Jeffries came. And Colonel Jeffries actually marched us out of Aycliffe, marched us to Barnet Castle. We went through round by Walworth Castle and then through Gainford and Winston, and then on to Westwick.
And the whole battalion marched?
The whole battalion marched, yes, quite a day.
Jeffrey's a much younger man than McBain.
Yes, oh yes. He's 88 now. Still alive.
And you say that he was very well liked?
Very well liked. He was efficient officer. Again, very human man, a gentleman. I think that's one of the features of an officer. Most of them were gentlemen.
What date did you move to Barnet Castle?
I think it was either June or July 1942. And just to be Midlands, a full corporal.
And that would be another increase in pay?
Yes, which went home.
Where were you stationed in Barnet Castle?
At Westwick Camp.
And what was that like as a camp?
That was a new camp, constructed in the normal manner. There still remain some of them. That one doesn't, Westwick doesn't. But it was also adjacent to another camp at Humbledon. Or Humbleton, I'm not quite sure. Humbleton. And that was the headquarters of the School of Infantry, with its own staffing arrangements. You see, we were just the battalion in attendance to do the bidding of the school itself.
Can you describe any of the life that you had at Westlake, was it you called it?
Westwick.
Westwick.
Westwick, yes. Well, at the time, you know, I mean, there's thousands of troops at Barnet Castle. They were in Deebold and Stainton and Stardforth and what was the other one that began with a B? But there was quite a lot of camps in the area, and they were all a similar type. A room that would hold a platoon, again with a pot-bellied stove, with two bunks, good access, more or less in a perimeter fashion, but we didn't have a parade ground as such. We had a part where it was for the, I think, more for the motor section of the battalion, transport section. But we had a field where we would drill, etc. But we didn't drill as much as we did manoeuvring work and tactics and schemes as appropriate to the School of Infantry. The whole system of our military training changed at that point, as soon as we got to Westwick. And we were taught things, of course, which was wasn't granted to other regimental battalions. Even battalions that were in action, I doubt whether they would receive the same training as we did. Of course, we didn't receive the same type of conditions they did.
Who was teaching you these things? They must have been pretty experienced men.
Well, the tactics of weaponry, we taught ourselves. You see, we had our own battalion to do this, but we were advancing all the time. At that time, we were introduced to the S Company, received a 6-pounder gun. I don't think anybody else had tested it. I spoke with Ted Green not too long ago. Ted was with the 6-pounder anti-tank gun. The tactics which we showed on demonstrations, these were the plans and the procedures outlined by the School of Infantry, which was led by Lieutenant Colonel Wigram, a young solicitor from London, about 30-year-old, who was very, very keen on this type of thing. The School of Infantry, of course, was an idea of Field Marshal Alexander from way back.
Were you taking in, obviously, the experiences that had gone before, the successes and the failures of infantry fighting before? Were these coming in as lessons to be learned?
Well, we were bringing in new procedures, new ideas. I mean, one of the things that we became very experienced at was advancing behind an artillery barrage of 25-pounders. We'd move about 100 yards behind them. Now, this type of experience hadn't been shown or taught to some of the lads who were in war, fighting in the desert and Burma and places like that. So that what we were learning was what we were actually going to do. The only thing that we weren't getting was that as well as shells going over the top of our heads, there was also shells coming towards us. That's what they were learning where they were in battle zones. But the manoeuvres, we had special places in and around Bowes Moor and Scargill and places like that, and it was to those positions where we would go and demonstrate when there would be a platform, a hill or something like that, where the officers and the VIPs would be watch us go in, you see. Very lifelike.
Who were you demonstrating to? Were these officers coming along to pick up new methods that you were showing?
Well, on one occasion, we did a house clearing exercise actually in the grounds of the School of Infantry. And there was no officer on view that I saw below the rank of major. Most of the officers had red tabs, red hats, red bands.
So what was the idea? These people would watch you doing this,
yes.
And then would they take that away?
And they would go back to there and show them how to do it. They were back to their own battalion. We also had a lot of VIPs. Winston Churchill was there once or twice. I'm not too sure that the Princess Elizabeth didn't attend. There was one occasion when all these high-ranking officers, which were a bit intimidatory, you know, I mean, when you're watching these people. And one was sitting on his shooting stick, and someone came up to me, and the officer of the battle school, and he said, "Your name?" I said, "Corporal Watts." He says, "Corporal Watts, I want you to tell the gentleman over there what you're going to do." Well, there I was, 5'4", 8 stone wet through, and I had to tell majors, colonels, brigadiers, lieutenant generals what to do. What I was going to do. I was frightened to death. I grabbed he says, "Take a deep breath and then just tell the gentleman what you're going to do." And I explained precisely how my section would clear the different rooms of the houses that were to be cleared. And afterwards, one of the majors came across and said, "Well done, Corporal, that was quite good." And I was over the moon. And from that moment on, I think that was when I could get confidence to stand up and talk to anybody about anything. Mm-hmm.